where we end up with destabilized regions. We end up with where we have populations that are subjected, where we have oppression. This is where it starts. When you look at autocratic fascist leaders in this particular instance, turn the other way and say, well, they're just normal state players, and ignore the fact that these are rogue authoritarian dictatorships. You allow for that impunity. You aid and abet it in a lot of ways. And that's what we've seen with COP29. In violation of the Geneva Conventions, as well as treaties that ceasefire agreements that Azerbaijan itself has signed, Aliyev himself signed them, we still have Armenian prisoners of war sitting in prisons in Baku, clearly tortured. And we have civilian hostages there as well. The fact that you're holding a UN summit in Baku under these conditions is absolutely ridiculous. You know, it's almost, like I said at the start, it's almost comedic if it weren't true.
Yes, and you say aiding and abetting. I might even suggest there's a level of complicity with all of these international bodies.
You know, I would agree. There are instances where you have open knowledge, and this is, you know, and an example that I've brought before, where you have open knowledge of genocidal intent, and you are advocating, not standing aside and saying we'll see what happens, but openly advocating to push the people into the clutches of the government that is seeking to destroy them. I do think that goes way beyond aiding and abetting. It might even go beyond complicity, Heidi, you know, unfortunately. And that's what's happened in this particular case. Many governments knew, and their representatives on the ground knew much more than the rest of the world did, of what Aliyev was planning. Not only did they let him do it, but they also browbeat the Nagorno-Karabakh Armenians into trying to make them accept subjugation as an outcome. And what they did, what the Artsakh Armenians did, is that they showed them with their feet that they are not going to take, no mother would send her child into the clutches of a regime that is intent on destroying them. That doesn't make any sense. But the reason why that didn't make any sense, Heidi, is because the governments were seeking, and very powerful governments, including the United States, were seeking to avoid the reality that Ilham Aliyev has genocidal intent. And I think that's where the difficulty now, when you study what's happening on the borders of Armenia, where Azerbaijan has now taken villages inside sovereign Armenia and mountaintops and controlling, projecting power into sovereign Armenian territory, it's because Aliyev doesn't care whether the Armenian is from Nagorno-Karabakh or from the southern region of Sunik or Tavush. He's called all of it Western Azerbaijan. In his mind, that's his. Nagorno-Karabakh was the Sudetenland of the South Caucasus.
Oh, I'm so sorry that we've run out of time, Karnig. How can our listeners follow your work?
Well, we mention a lot of the stuff that we do on social media. The Armenian Legal Defense Front is an NGO that we've just recently put together to kind of support some of the work that we're doing.
We thank you, Karnig, for your wonderful work in this difficult situation, and we will be following you on social media. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Heidi. It was a pleasure.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
This is Brad Keselowski, driver number 2, Discount Tire Ford Mustang. Racing fans know that a quick pit stop to check the tires can give me the winning edge. The same is true for your car. Proper tire tread helps keep traction on the road and everyday driving. To check your tread, simply insert a penny, Lincoln's head first, into your tire grooves. If you can see all of Honest Abe's head, it's time to get your tires checked by a professional.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.
You are listening to The Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
Hi. My name is Alina Akbar Khan, and I'm a first-year MFA student here at Carnegie Mellon University. I'm recording this audio in response to my first prompt for the contextual practice seminar that we're doing this semester. And one of the first questions that I'm required to respond to is this question of transmission, or what is it that I want to transmit? Honestly, I do not have an easy answer to this question, just because I'm not going through something easy in my life right now, by which I mean that I have traveled a great distance, like quite literally more than 7,000 miles to come study here in the United States. I'm originally from Pakistan, and I just moved here less than 5 to 6 months ago. And this question of what do I want to transmit is a little difficult for me to respond to, just because I think I'm adapting to a whole new culture, a whole new environment, while actively doubting my, you know, we are in a climate of political uncertainty. So I'm thinking a lot about my future. I'm thinking a lot about my present. And on that note, on the note of present, I think what I would like to transmit is an active engagement with the world around me, the world that I'm building in my studio. I'm primarily here, I mean, I'm here to learn how to be an artist. And that is an interesting position to be in, because how does one learn how to be an artist? I think I will be transmitting this experience of coming all the way here to interact and engage with communities and artists, visiting artists, lecturers, my professors, and my fellow peers, all of who are dedicated to this thing that we all collectively put a lot of faith in, called art. And so my engagement with this, with art itself, will probably become the content of these audio recordings for the next few weeks. Who am I? I'm an interdisciplinary artist working between Pakistan and the United States. My work is very interdisciplinary in that I mainly work between mediums such as drawing, publication, installation, sculpture, video, and sound most recently. And I'm thinking a lot about sounds, specifically because I'm also taking an elective here at School of Music called the Experimental Sound Synthesis, in which we are encouraged to think about sound in a very expanded field. And I want to especially share one particular instance from our lecture where the professor made us all do this exercise in active listening, in which we all had to close our eyes, and for 10 consecutive minutes we all had to like listen really closely to one sound source and follow it all the way to where we could hear where the sound was coming from. And interestingly, there was a sound of dripping water in the room, and I was drawn in by that sound. And then in trying to track the source of that sound, I started thinking about how water is ever present all around us, especially in us. So what sounds compose me, I think, and I'm reminded of this artist who came to give us an artist talk here, Guadalupe Maravilla, I guess, who said that our bodies are 80% water. And so what are we composed of? The sound that I'm composed of is just the vibration of water. So in a way, actively thinking about sound makes you way more aware of your own positionality within the world in a very literal way, in a way that I've really enjoyed thinking about recently in our experimental synthesis class. The prompt also requires me to respond to this question of what is the sound of home? Now, this is going to be an emotional question for me, and I don't think that I'm going to hold back on this one. Sound of home. I do not believe that I have a home at the moment, just because I feel an extreme... I did uproot my life also. So traveling all the way here in a new culture, in a new environment, I don't think that I have found home yet. So sound of home. Home is quiet, far away. And the sound of home is birds chirping in the morning. Sound of home is my mother's voice. Sound of home is my brother's voice. Sound of home is many things. My country has a lot of noise, in a way that it is difficult for me to explain. But I have found that when we think about active and passive sounds, in America, everything seems to be organized on the surface, at least. And you hear, and there's like a calmness in the space and in the landscape actively. In Pakistan, however, that's not the case. A dysfunction also like characterizes the landscape there. And so there's like a hyperstimulate, an environment that is very hyperstimulated, and it's a very busy place to be in. So there's a lot of noise, but it's a noise that you just learn to live with, and it doesn't bother you. And it's a noise that has a lot of warmth to it. And sound of home, I suppose, is many, many things, but it is a warm noise that I will say constitutes the sound of home for me. And I deeply miss that sound. The next question that the prompt requires me to respond to is my earliest memory of sound. I believe I can say that my earliest memory of sound and the most recent memory of sound, I think, are one thing. But well, let me just try to answer the earliest memory of sound. So my father moved away. So my father moved abroad when I was really, really young. And one thing that I remember from my earliest childhood memories is talking to him through a phone. So I think about this a lot, how sound is a very intangible thing, but when your relationships become sound becomes way more tangible than one might expect it to be. And so electronic sound, or when sound becomes a relationship, or when a relationship is reduced to sound, is something that I'm thinking a lot in the studio right now. And that is also my earliest memory of sound. Or when I started to think about sound in a serious manner, I think about my interactions with my father through a phone, and how the relationship just became sound for like a very long time. My most recent memory of sound is probably just from an hour ago when I was making electronic music on my laptop. And this is the first time that I have tried to make electronic music. And I don't mean music in a strict sense. I'm just experimenting with some electronic softwares to produce sound on my laptop, which is interesting, which is an interesting experience. But on a more active level, I think my most recent memory is just right now being in the studio, hearing one of the third years drag stuff from their studio to the other studio because they're making work, and just hearing conversations in the hallways. And I also want to emphasize that sound is not just the heard sound, but also sound is an interaction, a conversation, a reason to be with someone. And in that way, I think there's a lot of sounds that I'm reminded of when I think of my recent memory of sound. Like the other day, me and a couple of other graduate students here in the MFA were just talking about our experiences in the art world and the larger detachment of that we have felt coming from international context, the larger detachment that we have felt within the university when it comes to art. And we talk about community a lot. And one thing that we were talking about is how the built architecture of this place, of this university does not allow for fluid conversations to happen. You have to go out of your way to find people who are willing to talk to you. But on that note, I've also interacted with people from other departments who have felt the same way, and we've been able to connect and have had really interesting conversations, which brings me to the earlier question that was asked, what do you wish to transmit? I think CMU is ultimately a space for collaboration. Coming from a very traditional art school background, I have struggled with finding community here, but I've accepted that I might not be able to find a rigorous art-heavy community outside of my cohort or outside of the MFA or the art department, which is why I've committed to going out and finding people. So this other day, I was talking to a graduate student in the biotech, and we were having an interesting conversation. And what do I wish to transmit? I think I will be a very exciting experience to communicate my interactions across disciplines, and people from architecture, people from science, people from humanities. I will be speaking with them and recording my interactions with them, and will be sharing them on this platform. And I think that will be a fruitful and productive activity, not just for me, but for the listeners and for everyone who came to CMU in hopes of finding a collaborative and interdisciplinary environment.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
Annie Chen.
Intro music fades in. Warm, inviting tone. Thank you. Good morning, Pittsburgh. You're tuned in to WRCT 88.3, where we bring you stories that inspire and intrigue. I'm your host, and today we're diving into something a little mystical, a little cozy, the fascinating intersection of Feng Shui and our feline friends, with a special focus on our Carnegie Mellon students looking to transform their dorms into cozy, productive sanctuaries. Soft chime sound effect. Now, you might be wondering, what does an ancient Chinese practice of arranging space have to do with gates and college dorm rooms in Oakland? Well, more than you might think. Feng Shui is all about balancing energy, or qi, to create harmony in our spaces. And let's face it, dorm rooms at Carnegie Mellon can be tight and chaotic, but with a little Feng Shui magic, and maybe a cat pillow or two, you can create a study haven that feels both productive and peaceful. Soft purring sound effect. Let's start with placement. Your desk is the powerhouse of your dorm. Position it so you face the door. This is called the command position in Feng Shui. It helps you feel more in control and less stressed. If that's not possible, a small mirror on your desk can reflect the door. Same effect. Light tapping of keyboard sound effect. Next, up vertical space. Just like cats love climbing, students can benefit from going vertical. Use shelves to organize textbooks and supplies and hang calming artwork. Maybe a serene landscape or abstract art to inspire creativity. Wall-mounted shelves or hanging organizers free up precious desk space, keeping things airy and open. Soft page-turning sound effect. Colors play a big role too. Soft greens and blues encourage focus and calm. Great for late-night coding sessions or exam cramming. Earthy tones can ground you during those stressful project deadlines. Add a plush throw or a cozy pillow in these shades to your bed or study chair. You could even incorporate mood lighting with string lights in warm tones to soften the harshness of overhead lights. Soft whoosh sound effect. Lighting is another game changer. Dorms often have harsh overhead lights. Try adding a small desk lamp with warm, soft light to create a cozy ambiance. And natural light, gold. Open those blinds and let the sun shine in. You can also use LED candles for a safe, flickering glow that brings in the fire element without setting off the dorm smoke alarms. Soft curtain. Rustling sound effect. For a touch of nature, add plants, but keep them cat safe if your dorm allows pets. Spider plants, bamboo, or even a small succulent can breathe life into your room. Don't forget that plants bring in the wood element, symbolizing growth, perfect for students. Hanging planters can also free up desk space while adding a vertical green touch. Soft rustling leaves sound effect. Clutter. Oh, the clutter. It blocks energy and focus. Keep your desk clear, use underbed storage, and remember, if your cat would knock it off a shelf, maybe it shouldn't be there. Consider using decorative baskets or bins to store items neatly and keep the space feeling open. Laughter sound effect. Need to distress? Incorporate scent. Use essential oils. Lavender for relaxation, peppermint for focus. But skip the harsh sprays. Natural scents are key for clear energy. You might try a small diffuser or sachets tucked into your drawers for a gentle, calming fragrance. soft bell chime sound effect. Let's not overlook study breaks. Create a cozy corner with a soft blanket, your favorite book, or a playlist of relaxing music. Feng Shui encourages balance. Work hard, but rest well. Even a small meditation cushion can offer a spot for mindfulness during stressful times. Soft music fade in, gentle lo-fi beats. And speaking of music, don't underestimate the power of sound. Soft background music or nature sounds can enhance focus and relaxation. White noise machines or apps with ocean waves, rain, or soft winds can drown out hallway noise and create a peaceful bubble. Soft rain sound effect. Carnegie Mellon students, whether you're cramming in Hunter Library or chilling in your Morwood dorm, Feng Shui can help make your space work for you. Small changes, better desk placement, soft lighting, and cozy textiles can transform your room into a peaceful, productive sanctuary. Soft wind chime sound effect. Now, let's talk about technology. Keep cords organized. Tangled cables create mental clutter. Use cord organizers or clips to keep them neat and out of sight. Also, consider limiting screen time before bed by switching to soft lighting and engaging in a relaxing, non-digital activity. Soft click of a lamp turning off.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
Morgan Thomas Schenkweiler.
3, 2, 1, go. No.
All right, so let's just warm up by going, yow, yow. Yow. Over-exaggerating your jaw. Yow.
Yow. Yow.
Now let's add some resonance to that. Meow. Meow. Meow.
Meow.
Meow. Wow. We're going to do this one. This is a good one. To work diaphragm. And we're going to go, ha, ha, ha. Ha, ha, but put your hand right under your rib cage. Ha, 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 and you should feel that pulse. Ha, 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 is we're going to think about resonance on the mmm. So we're going to do this. Mmm, 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 together, ready? And mmm, vast resonance. Me, me, ma, mo, mo. And me, always resonating. Remembering how to really use our diaphragm and get that ha, 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 ha. Put your hand back on your diaphragm. Ready? Here we go. And ha, 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 ha. Our jaws relaxed by doing this. Ya 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 ya. Ya 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 ya. Relax the jaw. Ya 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 ya. Ya 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 ya. Ya 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 ya. Hung ye, hung, hung ye, hung ye, hung ye, hung ye, hung ye, hung ye, hung ye. That is to make sure that the base of your tongue is relaxed. Hung ye, hung ye, hung ye, hung ye. Hung ye, 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 hung ye. Let's try another one for the tongue. Actually, everything. Say where.
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 Where. Where. Because it starts with an ooh. Where? Now, this is going to be your jaw. Sha.
Sha.
Now, this is going to be the tip of the tongue. Shall I?
Shall I?
Now, here comes the base of the tongue. Go.
Go.
To. Back to lips. Day.
Day.
Where shall I go today? Where shall I go today? On the top note, it's so important to have a relaxed tongue. Or you sound like you're swallowing your sound, right? One of the most neutral sounds, ga, is on the top note. Ga, And to say a G, you have to have a relaxed tongue. So it's, where shall I go today? Where shall I go today? Nice. Flick of air to get that top note. Where shall I go today? Try it together. Ready? And.
Where shall I go today? 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 Where shall I go today?
Nice.
Where shall I go today? Where shall I go today? Where shall I go today?
One more.
Where shall I go today?
Nice.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was a good one. And the jaw just stays like you're almost going to drool out of the corner of your mouth. So the shape of that vowel sound is done with your mouth. The coolest thing is the O and the OO are done by your shape of your mouth.
It sounds different every time because you can't put your mouth in the same exact shape.
When I'm working with students and I want their diction to be really good, it's very important that you think of your diction being very forward, so your consonants and the shape of your consonants do not impede the resonance of your vocal cords.
Yeah.
So, is it harder to toot or to toot or to toot or to toot? Do you want to try that one? Stay relaxed. Go ahead.
Is it harder to toot or to toot or to toot or to toot? Your turn.
Okay, ready? Is it harder to toot or to toot or to toot or to toot?
Can you say it more in a head voice?
Is it harder to toot or to toot or to toot or to toot?
Let me try. Is it harder to toot or to toot or to toot or to toot?
To tooters.
To tooters. To
You don't understand how much air consonants take. So we're going to do a little fun thing. These are unvoiced consonants. Go ahead, you want to try yours?
Yeah.
Right? They're all unvoiced. All right. So, pick a rhythm. So, some air support also. So, some lip trills. Flutter tongue?
Can we do a couple more tongue twisters and then be done?
Ah, which one do you want to do? And again, just keep it crisp, keep it forward.
How much wood could a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood? He'd chuck as much as a woodchuck could if a woodchuck
could. How much wood could a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood? He'd chuck as much as a woodchuck could. How much wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood? He would chuck he would as much as he could. And chuck as much as a woodchuck would if a woodchuck could chuck wood.
Yellow butter, purple jelly, red jam, black bread, spread it thick, say
yellow
it
butter,
quick.
Purple jelly, red jam, black bread, spread it thick, say it quick.
Yellow butter, purple jelly, red jam, black bread, spread
yellow
it
butter,
thick,
purple
say
jelly,
it quick.
Red jam, black bread, spread it thick, click it,
my turn.
Click it, slick.
Yellow butter, purple jelly, jam. Yellow butter, purple jelly, red jam, black bread.
Yellow butter, purple
thick,
jelly, red jam, black bread. Spread it thick, say it quick.
That's about it. That was it.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
My name is Logan Larson. I rather like buying things. For the past few years, I bought fan-made materials related to actresses like Judy Garland, Elizabeth Taylor, and Mae West off eBay. Through these transactions, I often find myself buying from the same sellers. Some of them have established a mutual awareness of these repeated transactions and call it out in their correspondence with me, mentioning that they were happy to see my name again, or that they were pleased I found another gem from their collection. Some sellers throw in an extra gift or some sort of item that had been listed long enough to hand off to someone who might actually care. One seller even sent me a signed photograph of himself, standing with his accumulated collection of Judy Garland memorabilia, sharing with me the fact that he hoped to create a museum out of the materials one day. I spent a lot of time staring at his image, looking at what I had versus what he had, and comparing our respective assortments, attempting to place myself within the image and get a sense of the space. I'll describe the image for you. The seller, who I would say is in his mid to late 60s, stands in a seemingly endless field of Judy Garland memorabilia. The room he's in has edges, but they're obscured by the materials which seem to cover every surface in the room. The things I can discern include dresses arranged on mannequins, various movie posters from Garland's films, records, signed photographs, newspaper clippings, scrapbooks, and zines, among many other gems that are probably obscured by the sheer quantity of items occupying the frame. The image itself is printed on 8.5 by 11 inch paper, with a sleek surface luster of a FedEx color copy, signed in Sharpie with the comment, "I hope you enjoy these," from one Judy fan to another, with his name autographed below. Over the course of a few months, I had bought a number of zines from this seller on eBay, specifically those produced in the 1990s by members of the Judy Garland fan club. The club, which still exists today, began in the early 1960s while Garland was still alive. It aimed to publish new writings submitted by members, reprinted articles from other sources, and shared ways of exchanging or buying Garland items like records and books. For its part, the zine served as a meeting point for fans of Garland. Reading some of the submissions from this series, one gets a real sense of the dedication and care that members of the club got from taking part. One article that was particularly poignant to me was a request submitted by a young woman who wrote in to ask for support of Garland's Flower Fund, a group which put fresh flowers on the grave of the singer and actress each month after her death. This zine was produced in the late 1990s, almost 20 years after Garland's death. This responsibility of heading the Flower Fund was passed down from member to member over the decades. And in this young woman's request to the membership, she asked for support in paying the monthly flower bill. As she shares, she's a student on a limited budget who can no longer cover the overage each month. The cover of this issue included a black and white photograph of Garland's grave, covered in bouquets left by fans. Blackened and blown out by the method of reproduction, the flowers become a Xeroxed mass when seen on the cover, but the act is captured. Subsequent issues of the publication include the news that additional funding was secured by the membership to support the effort. And though I'm not sure of the destiny of the Flower Fund today, if it still exists, the memory of the act remains in the pages of the zine left behind by its collector. In accumulating my own collections, the responsibility of preserving these materials takes on an unexpected weight. I see myself as a temporary caretaker, maintaining these materials to eventually hand off to another person down the line. My act of collecting is based in care and preservation, preserving things that weren't always meant to last. Before I moved to Pittsburgh for graduate school, I discovered that a doctor in Austin was himself a major collector of Judy Garland memorabilia. Not the zines and scrapbooks I looked for, but the real stuff. The costume jewels, the prop bed she slept on, and the dresses she donned on screen. On his Instagram, he shares images of the objects he acquires, how he cares for them, wrapping them in acid-free tissue paper, and building custom clamshell boxes for them. He's the real caretaker, a real devotee, and a true follower. I'm particularly attracted to one costume necklace he owns. Donned by Garland in the 1945 film Ziegfeld Follies, it's a jeweled piece that's supposed to appear as if it's a loose knot of diamonds tied together, with each end finishing in an abstracted wing form. In this segment of the Follies entitled A Great Lady Has an Interview, Garland emerges out of a glowing orange closet where she meets a horde of young male journalists there to seduce an interview out of her. In the 10-minute segment from the larger film, she goes on to toy with the crowd of young fellows for a few minutes, teasing them with the slightest hints at her upcoming film role yet to be revealed. In the scene, she moves quickly around the room, jetting from journalist to journalist, ending up saluting a painting of herself adorned in a gilded frame, and lounging on a desk set with two gnarly-looking flower arrangements. The room is a grayish-brown, and all the young men wear black tuxedos, so Garland in her sky-blue gown lights up the room. It's hard not to look at her in her complimentary color tone, or her necklace, which seems so effortlessly to catch the light in each shot. The cohort goes on to join in dance, accompanying Garland, who leads the troupe of queer-coded young admirers, in a song. The scene was mentioned in one of the first biographies I read about Garland, titled The Other Side of the Rainbow by Mel Torme. A collaborator on The Judy Garland Show, Torme derogatorily called this scene from The Follies the F. Slurs national anthem, and that the audiences who filled the TV show's taping all pledged allegiance to it. This slight against Garland's queer following stuck with me, and it gave me a way to look at Garland and begin to consume her long career. The scene from The Follies is very queer. Of course, there's the glowing closet, but there is also the absurdity of the room's non-space, and the film role that Garland eventually reveals to the press pool, that she will play the role of the inventor of the safety pin. I reached out to the collector who owns this necklace once to try to speak to him about his collecting habits, and potentially to try to see pieces from his collection, but I didn't get a response. I understand it, though. I think he's scared of letting people in, as it would make his collection too vulnerable to outsiders. I think about the closet accumulators in my work, the closet fans. For so long, movie stars of the 20th century, figures like Garland, had covert meanings in the communities who looked to them. A Friend of Dorothy was meant as a way to ask if someone was queer, and The Wizard of Oz served as a wellspring of queer codes there to be decoded and appropriated. The original Pride flag, designed by Gilbert Baker in 1978, was created with the song Over the Rainbow in mind, and name a queerer character than the Cowardly Lion. Dorothy's journey through Oz is defined by the gaze she picks up along the way. Rewatch the film, and you'll see what I'm talking about. I want to end with the thing that first made me interested in Garland. I heard the much-circulated rumor that Garland's death had initiated the 1969 Stonewall riots. This, I thought, absurd, but I wanted to know more, how this attribution came to be. Garland's funeral did indeed happen on the day of the Stonewall riots, only a few blocks away in Manhattan. Fans poured out to mourn the icon in public and view her before her final rest. For many, it was a way to pay respect to the person who took them to the land of Technicolor, and for others, a ray of hope. But Stonewall? How could they be related? I discovered that the tying of Garland's death to Stonewall came about as a way to slight the rioters who initiated the uprising, a rumor which circulated in the newspapers in the days following the riots. A way to say, the gays were so upset last night that they rioted. The connecting of Garland to Stonewall discounts the anger and injustice done to the black and brown populations who initiated the riots that night. But I believe there is also the potential to take back control of this attribution, to take back ownership of this mythology, and allow ourselves to have a litany of fantastical tie-ins to Stonewall. Let us generate our own history, our own way of telling stories, and exist in the gray zone of an event as large and as impactful as Stonewall. While there aren't any images of the Stonewall riots, just images of its after effects, I have an image from Garland's memorial that I've used in my work. A photograph showing a group of young mourners sitting on the sidewalk behind police barricades. They sit on the street and play records of Garland's on a portable turntable. Crowded around, they listen to the icon revived, her voice active once more, even if her body lays in the funeral home they patiently wait to enter. While I don't consider myself a fan of Garland, which I know is hard to believe after hearing this segment, I find beauty in the acts of those who are true fans. I believe fandom is both about the personal act of adoration, reverence paid to a star, and the community building of collective fandom, an approach to mutual understanding and relation. I've only watched a few of Garland's films, even though I've spent many hours in the cultural materials that accompanied her life. I like to access her through the matter that her fans produced and labored over. I ask that they let me be their temporary guardian, a way lane for her memory to remain, and I'll continue to slowly slog through the materials that emerge.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
Hello, this is Ashley Ross, and the title of this piece is Good Morning Pittsburgh, What a Walk in 1 Degree Weather Sounds Like. Enjoy.
Do